Thank you, Joe. It's a great pleasure to have a chance to speak here and tell you about not only our experiments. The plan for me this afternoon is to put what we do on, let's say, superconducting quantum circuits in a bit broader perspective, show some other experimental results. But still, our DELT results will be out of proportion in their representation. I mean, I hope you allow me that. Now, what I will be talking about this afternoon is our circuits, and this is the typical thing you should have in mind. This is still how all the groups in this area make their samples. You're looking at aluminum films. It's almost still always aluminum, one of the simplest superconductors. Structures where there are layers and they're not perfect. You can see there are grains, but that doesn't matter too much, or maybe it does. I'll come back to that. And the important things are the junctions, the Josephson junctions here. And Josephson junctions are just aluminum, aluminum oxide, aluminum junctions. So we have a tunnel barrier, a thin tunnel barrier. And because it has to be very thin, these samples have to be made in situ. We put down one film, evaporating aluminum under an angle, then oxidize it in situ, and then evaporate the counter electrode under another angle, so that we get this type of overlap. And you can see that everything is double, I mean, because it's evaporated through a free mask there. So these are the junctions. So in this case, there are four small junctions, and the junctions here are typical sizes, like 100 nanometers. If you want to be in the charging regime, they're smaller, maybe 50 nanometers. The other case, they're a bit bigger. But anyway, you can see the junctions here. Now, what we do in this way, make circuits, and we can pass a current through the circuit from here to there. In that case, it's important that this is an island that has only weak connections to the strong leads. These are continuous leads, but this island, for instance, is isolated from those leads through maybe high impedance tunnel junctions. And that means that the charging energy, if you put one extra electron there or one extra Cooper pair, single Cooper pair, creates a certain energy here, depending on the capacitance of that island, total capacitance in particular of those two junctions, because the junction capacitance dominates the capacitance in this case, let's say the third one there. So that charging energy connected to this one Cooper pair, one electron, is significant here. And the other thing in this picture that you should notice is that there are loops, that we have closed circuits, and they enclose flux, and that is the other important. So for superconductors, it's very important that if we go around, that the order parameter has the same phase by or 2 pi or n times 2 pi added, and these are the important differences. And we can also influence, in particular, the charging effects by gates that are next to an island like that. We put a voltage here, the electrostatic potential there changes, and we can influence the charge states. Okay, so this is the general type of thing I'll be talking about. I'll discuss, go a bit into the background first, then talk about number and charge states, then talk about phase flux states, and there I'll mention the results we have and what we are trying to do, and then I'll, at the end, discuss some very recent results, not obtained by us, but by others. I'll come to it, and they're not published yet, I just heard of them, but they're very interesting. So I think it's good to tell you about them. Now, just to start in the basics of Josephson junctions, this everybody's supposed to know. Superconductors, order parameter, modulus and a phase. And for Josephson junctions, the difference in the phase is important. We have phase on both sides of the barriers. We have to take the gauge invariant phase to add the vector potential part. We have a Josephson energy, and if there's a voltage across the junction, there is a time dependence, the phase, or I should mention the gauge invariant phase, changes in time. And then also I'll probably later forget to mention that the flux quantum phi zero is h over 2e. That will come into the equations quite often. And the symbol for a junction is this cross. Also important. So we have the two regimes. If we, in general, have a system, now let's first look at this part. We have an island, junctions, and as I mentioned before, the Coulomb charging energy, particular if EC, and EC is E squared over C. So if C is small, if the capacitance is small, this is a large energy. If that energy is much stronger than the Joulson energy, the thing behaves mainly just as a charging. If it's extremely much larger, then all it does is count Cooper pairs. So the number of Cooper pairs is all dominant. And the presence of a small Joulson energy couples charge states. So if there is an EJ, by definition, Cooper pairs can tunnel. So number states are coupled through the Joulson energy, the Joulson processes. This is the other side, if you have a loop. This is more relevant in the case that the Joulson energy dominates. There are excitations that are connected with, if you go around a loop like that, if you add all the phase differences, do they add up to zero or do they add up to 2 pi or something else? And that is influenced by the flux applied to the loop, the same way as the charge states are influenced by a gate voltage. And these are the excitations in that regime. And here, the Joulson energy is larger, but if the charging energy is zero, means that the capacitance is very large. And in these circuits, capacitance plays the role of mass. So if the capacitance is large, mass is large, it's a classical system. But if the charging energy is smaller but still significant, then we can have motion in phase space, I'll come to it, and we can have quantum tunneling. And for these superconducting systems, if we have a piece of superconductor, we have a Heisenberg uncertainty relation between number and phase. And I won't show it, but we have shown that experimentally also, that's possible. Now let me go back about 15 years or so, more than that. And this is where we all were at that time. Now this is the Joulson junction. Junction has capacitance. In general, it also has a normal, a quasi-particle channel, dissipative channel. Could have added that there. It's current biased. This is the energy for the system. So it has the charging energy, the Coulomb energy, it has the Joulson energy, and this is what a current source, infinite impedance current source, gives as the free energy for the system. So linear term, if phase and current there. Now, if we look at this energy, and then for the time being forget about that term, and take the bare and call that a Hamiltonian now, where we have a kinetic energy part and a potential energy. I mean, that's an obvious connection here. We can do that if we call the mass, as I said before, proportional to C with this proportionality term. We can define this as a momentum. And now, of course, this looks very familiar. And then what people did at that time, which is something you have to think about. I mean, you have an equation that describes your system, looks like that. And we know if we call that position and we call that momentum, I mean, why not quantize that? But we're dealing with a superconductor, which of course is a quantum system, and I mean, band structure in solid state, which is all quantum. But now we quantize once again. And now the question is that reasonable? There were lots of discussions at that time whether that was a reasonable thing to do. But as I'll show you in the next minutes, I mean, it seems to work, so we all believe that we do that. We quantize it, we get a Schrödinger equation for this macroscopic system, for this junction in this case. Okay, and you can write it in several ways. I can keep the mass there, but I can also convert it to the charging in it. So you see that this part is connected to the charging and the other, the Joulson energy. Now, if we add the current source, I mean, this is a periodic, This is what we have here is a periodic potential. So you form bands, I mean, all in the same way as in the solid. We have a particle with a small mass that moves in a potential energy, which is periodic. So you can define k vectors, and they're all connected with charge states directly. Now you can also drive the system. If you put a this is now similar to putting an electric field to an electron in a solid, in a metal, for instance, or in a semiconductor. If you put a current, we tilt the potential, and we get, I mean, added to this a linear term, and this is the potential. And as soon as the slope is steep enough, there are no stable positions anymore, we exceed the critical current. So this is what a critical current is. There is no hall, no potential well for the particle to sit in. It will keep going down this thing. Now if we blow it up, if we take a curve like that, this one, and blow it up, it looks like that. And now if the mass is small, it's obvious that in this potential, I mean, this is harmonic oscillator-like, and it should be, let's say, harmonic oscillator. I mean, the ground state would not be down in the well, but somewhere up. And the other part is that you expect that quantum tunneling through this potential should be possible. So this was investigated. The theory was worked out. And I think most of you know about the Caldera-Leggett theory for, I mean, one way of putting dissipation into quantum mechanics by simulating something ohmic by a set, a large number of harmonic oscillators. This actually was worked out for this problem for the first time. So that was applied. And here are a few experimental results, A485. This is the potential again. Actually, you can have more levels there. And these people showed that you can have resonant activation here from one level to another. And then once you are in the higher level, the tunneling down is much easier. And that can be recorded. And then the other part is this is the observation of the quantum tunneling through the well. If you know this is the thermal tunneling, and if you keep cooling it down lower and lower temperature, it levels off. This is by itself not proof enough, but if you combine this effect with that effect, this was a very clear indication that there was macroscopic quantum tunneling out of the potential in these Jellison junctions. 85, and now it's 2001, and there was quite some time in between where not much happened. So these are superconducting quantum systems, very interesting subject, everybody you would think would have gone on, but of course some other things happened. This was 85, but in 86 something else happened, and let's say 99.5% of all the groups in superconductivity suddenly shifted their attention to other materials and other effects. That's one part. But the other part, and actually that is more relevant here, is that also it was for the first time seen that single electrons could be controlled, and that was not primary first, not much in the superconducting state, but just in a normal state. So Fulton and Dolan, Bell Labs, they were the first to do it. But very soon after, other groups picked it up. We also did it in Delft. And in the first years, we tried to keep things relatively simple. We put a strong magnetic field on to have just the normal electrons, because we, from the first attempts, we noticed that superconductors were interesting but different in a way that we couldn't understand too well in the beginning. And it was better to start. So we studied single electron effects in these metallic junction systems. And then later also, similar things were seen in quantum dots, semiconductor quantum dots, and others. But these were the first effects. Now, once these single electron effects in aluminum circuits were understood, attention was also paid to the superconducting systems. And after a few years of those experiments, and now we're talking 93 here, this is an example of the type of measurement that could be done. What we have here, this is the circuit, and these are junctions. This is a slightly different symbol. these are junctions that are superconducting on that side and normal metal on that side. And this is from the Saclay group, who will come back. So what we have here is a small piece of superconductor. It's connected with a tunnel junction. So the Cooper pairs or other charges can tunnel through the junction, and the potential on that island can be influenced with the gate. Now what happens on this island can be measured with another object, and that other object is an electrometer. It's nothing but a single electron transistor. Actually, it's in a superconducting state, but this is just a measuring instrument. Once you have a small piece of metal, single electron transistor can be used as a measuring instrument of potentials, and it's obvious to use it in this case. And this is now a measurement. And what you see here are potentials. So this is what happens in normal state. You keep turning up the gate, and then all these parabola are charging energies for different numbers of electrons in this case. And they're all the same, but now if you do the same for a superconductor, suddenly there's a difference between an odd number or an even number of electrons on a piece of superconductor. And then you see that if you take this plot that you expect, in this case the gap is smaller than the charging energy, and then you expect these pieces in between where you would just see the odd numbered states, but this part would be much smaller here. And this is what was observed. This could really be seen. Now, it's very obvious, draw these pictures, but before that, and even during that, I remember very many discussions with theorists that explained to me that this could never be measured. What is a superconductor? How is the definition? How many Cooper pairs do you have in a superconductor? Nobody knows the answer to that one. It's a very difficult one. If you talk in a London picture, all the electrons participate. And if you take Ginzburg-London-Lowick approach, London approach, all the electrons are Cooper pairs. But if you take the BCS type of approach, you say it's limited to a narrow, essentially a narrow range around the Fermi level. And then it's pretty vague. This V that comes in the BCS theory, can be anything. It's just a number there. And it comes back in the TC, but it's not well understood. So nobody expects to have, let's say, an integer numbers of Cooper pairs there. Because, how could it ever be? So all these theorists, a significant percentage of theorists predicted that this could never happen. But if you do the experiment, you see it. It's there. Yeah, so may seem obvious, but if you think a little bit about it, it's not so obvious, but it's there. Okay. Now, to see this is not so obvious either. It took from 85 to 93 or so to really develop the technology to do all this, and I won't go into it, but you need extreme levels of filtering, different temperatures, high frequency range, very consistent photon shielding. A single photon from a 4 Kelvin thermal shield is enough to create a Cooper pair in aluminum. So a single photon creeping through a... So you have to make something that is completely closed also for photons that try to wiggle through a kind of shield. So you have to put your sample in a completely closed box with feed-through filters, which is not only... vacuum tight is not so important, photon tight is, etc. And then some groups like the Saclay group put in quasi-particle traps, we don't, and now you get into the black magic, and we all have our own tricks. Yeah, you need the measurement instruments, they're not so simple. And then you also have to understand quite well what the connections, how you connect your circuit, what kind of impedances you offer to the system. A bit of dissipation here or there can be good, but not too much, etc. So you also have to control that. And this is an example I showed you, this picture in the beginning. This is something that Caspar van der Wallendelf did. To take a measurement like that. Now this is looking at the maximum supercurrent from here to there as a function of the two gate voltages. This takes about 6 hours to measure. Now to measure this, you need to have I mean, these are islands that contain, let's say, a billion electrons. I mean, if there's one single quasi-particle there, the picture is lost. And it may have happened here, these lines just flashing by. Could also be a measurement problem. But this is we measured in real time. So the periodicity here corresponds to T2e, so to a Cooper pair charge. But to get this picture and not get something that is e-periodic, you have to take all these precautions. And let's say if you start with this, it's very difficult to get to this level. But OK, I mean, it's possible. And a number of groups, and quite many now, can do that. And now we come to the really interesting part. And this is the part where we connect to what is called quantum computing. I heard Boris Altshuler last week mention, I mean, the Queen of Spain and Columbus setting out and say, I'll go to India. And then, of course, he didn't get there, but in America now. He said, our India is the quantum computing. I feel like that also. I mean, so we are on our way to the quantum computer. But if we end up in America, we are happy too. We'll take it as it comes. OK, but this is the first measurement now of coherent motion in time. I mean, try to show you that we can control static states. And now we all try to get to the quantum operations in time. So drive quantum states in a way, in a controlled way, and investigate those. And this is the first measurement that has success. And until 2 months ago, the only one, or 1 month ago. And this is now working with charge states. So what you see here is this is the sample. It has an island again, and it has some other things. But let me show you. Here are the charge states. This is the gate voltage here. Zero charge on zero excess Cooper pairs, one excess Cooper pair. If you increase the voltage here, the one state has lower energy. There's a crossing here. But then, of course, if there's Josephson coupling, there's an avoided crossing. So these are the energies. And in the middle here, with a gate charge of one electron, half a Cooper pair, we expect to have the symmetric and the anti-symmetric combinations, as usual, let's say of zero and one states. Now what these people, Nakamura, Pashkin, Tsai did is start the system here. And then with their very fast pulse generator, a $500,000 pulse generator, 30 picosecond pulse, they switch to here and then let the system stand here. When they come from this is in a definite charge state. Here, that charge state is not the eigenstate, so it oscillates here, and then they switch back. And depending how long they let it oscillate here, it will come back either here or there. Yeah? And that is then measured using, and that is the second trick. So one trick they use is do it very fast, extremely fast. And the other is that they measure where they are using a very special Cooper pair quasi-particle combination process. So it turns out that if you do it right, that if you end up here, there will be a quasi-particle tunneling. And if you repeat it many times, you get enough quasi-particles tunneling that you can measure a current. So you have to repeat the pulse fast enough because you get one electron, a current of one electron per pulse. If you repeat the pulses fast enough, you get enough current to measure. And that is what they measure. Picoamp current, you can calculate how many pulses they use. Okay. So this is now varying the width of the pulse. Now, if you do that and calculate what you expect, this is the calculation, and this is the measurement. So that is pretty good. It's excellent, I would say. And this is 99. Yeah, so it's very good agreement. Now, why was it so difficult for others to repeat? And also, why was it so difficult for them to expand from here? Because they immediately tried also to have two islands and use an electrometer to measure, etc. And that, it turned out, was very difficult. And still is difficult. And that has to do with bad stuff that we don't like to talk about, but we have to deal with. If we fabricate these samples, in particular, if we work in the charge regime, we have a lot of 1/S noise. And I mean, the idea, we don't really know. I mean, there are very few real measurements, but I mean, if we have a system like that, and this would be a superconducting island and these tunnel barriers, if you have, for instance, that's the worst one, if in the barrier, in the insulating barrier, you have a defect, and a defect is charged. So if there's a charge, some ion there in the barrier, then it will create a random charge on this island and on that one. It will split its field lines if you want, but it will have a surface charge induced on this island, so the charge basis will be shifted. Now, if the charge is there and stays there, that's not so bad. I mean, you have to correct for it with your gate voltage. It acts as a gate in a way, but that is easy. But the bad thing is that there are a lot of defects, apparently, that charge and decharge all the time. So there's dynamic, there's noise. And it can be due to those things or something like that or something on the top. And this is a materials problem. It's only a materials problem, but it's not so easy to so. And the bad thing is that even if you would reduce the density of those defects, I mean, we have no idea basically how many there are. We know that if you make a circuit like that and it contains 100 islands, each island will have an offset charge that is completely random. It's not that it is this, I mean, that it has to be zero and has some kind of distribution around it. It's all the way between zero and one. And we can't tell whether it's between zero and one or between 1,000 and 1,001, because it all will, I mean, by tunneling, find the lowest state, and we can't see where that is. So it may be necessary to reduce it by many orders of magnitude, or maybe not, we don't know. But anyway, we know there's a strong static offset, and there's a lot of 1/F noise. And that is very important and has to be reduced to get this going. But okay, a certain level it is controlled. But as the NEC people, Nakamura and others, have shown, it's the 1/F noise that limits them and leads to a dephasing time of the order of, let's say, 10 nanoseconds. That is, and if they compare with known levels of 1/F noise, charge noise, these numbers are consistent. Now, similarly, you expect to have flux noise. There are magnetic impurities, there are maybe other things. There could be, if you use superconductors, you could have trapped vortices that detrap and retrap. So this is also a source of noise. And then the other thing is you could also have defects that are not ions, but still, I mean, could, if they're in the barrier, influence the tunneling strength. So there could be, let's say, critical current noise. This is the one we know least about. Now, in our experiments, we see that here we have a completely random offset, but in the flux, zero is zero, and there is maybe a little noise around it, but if we take a big system, and we've done that, if we make a system that has 1,000 or 10,000 loops, we can really tell what is zero, and we can make very narrow, I mean, the flux is controlled to certainly better than 1 in 1,000 from those experiments. And that's impossible with charges. So that is the reason why we in Delft decided to go for this system. Now, the static is not necessarily connected with the 1/F, but still it's reasonable to connect that. And I mentioned that we had, I'll tell you about our results, but the Stony Brook group of Jim Lukens also had similar results. They used excited state and we the lower states, but otherwise what we did is pretty much the same. So now, say a bit about our phase or flux quantum two-level systems. So what we made are loops that have three junctions. If you have three junctions, you have two in a loop, you have two independent phases, and in phase space, you get minima, and the whole thing is periodic. We try to avoid tunneling from over large distances. We like to keep it in the unit cell, that is to decrease the coupling to charge noise, but that is a detail. So we have a system with two minima. In this case, there is an applied flux slightly off half flux quantum. If the flux in the loop is half a flux quantum, these potential wells have the same energy, but we can tilt them by changing the flux in the loop. And then we can also change the barrier height by choosing in the first place what the junctions are. But if we make one of them a bit smaller than the others, we can reduce the barrier here and increase that barrier to the other tonic. So this is what we do. We take that 75 or 80% of the other two here. And the other part is the mass. So how strong is the charging? I mean, how small is the capacitance? If you make the capacitance really small, we can easily make the capacitance so small that the lowest energy level is somewhere up here, way above these two potentials, way above the barrier. But we make, consciously, we make the areas a bit larger than our technology allows, and then the mass is large enough that we go down in these wells. So we can tune in fabrication what the tunneling strength is between here and there. And we can, as I said, engineer the barrier height by the values of the junctions. Now, we aim for a two-level system, but in reality there are many more levels. We understand them, but we try to focus on this bit and have the other ones further away. But we have to keep that in mind, that they exist. Now, this is what we expect. In this case, we expect, because there's tunneling, there's an avoided crossing. That's the idea. And then this is the ground state, and the ground state, this is the energy. The derivative of the energy is the supercurrent in the loop. So the supercurrent is expected to have a step in the ground state like that, and the opposite in the first excited state. And this current generates, a circular current. For the numbers that we have, we expect that circulating current will generate 10 minus 3 flux quanta, which is in principle can be measured. And this can also be used to couple one loop to another loop. So we can couple it to a measuring instrument, but also couple it to another loop, and then get conditional effects. Yeah. Okay. Now we measure. The measurement is done by surrounding the qubit, the loop, with a measuring squid, a measuring instrument. The critical current of this thing depends on the flux it enclosed, and that depends on the state of the qubit. Now, the measurement is done by ramping up the current of the squid. It has to be an unshunted squid, one that has no dissipation. So you ramp it up, and then it switches to basically to the gap. Sorry, this way. This is the current. Switches to the gap. This is the gap voltage. There's some heating. It doesn't matter. We register when it switches and let it come back and do it again. And we do that 5,000 times or 10,000 times. So in the end, it's a kind of ensemble measurement. It's a single object, but multiple measurements. So we make an ensemble of about 10,000 independent measurements. And the actual signal, this flux that we generate, is only a fraction of the width of the histogram. So a single measurement gives no information about the state. And this is what the squid signal looks like. The squid also feels the applied flux. But then we can blow this up and subtract the slope. And then we get the pictures that I show you here. We get a picture like that, the step that I showed you previously. So this is the qubit signal now, the step. And then also in this case, we have applied a microwave, a continuous microwave signal. And the frequency of the microwaves corresponds to an energy splitting somewhere there. If it is resonant here, it's also resonant there. So we get transitions from the ground state to an excited state. In this case, this direction here from the ground state to excited state going up. Yeah, so this is what we see. Now we can do that for different frequencies and it moves. And so in that way, we can measure what the energy difference between the levels is as a function of applied flux. And then we see that it does not follow a straight line, that it really deviates significantly. I mean, this is significant deviation, and that proves that there is a quantum superposition now of these two states. And now, yeah, you have to remember, we're talking about states that are loops, and in these loops, in one state, all the Cooper pairs go this way, and in the other state, they all go that way, and in the superposition, all of them go both this way and that way. Not half of them this way and the other half that way, but they all go this way and that way. So, this is more macroscopic than many other things in quantum physics. How macroscopic? Now, this is something that I'm sure you all would like a two-hour discussion about, but I have not so much to say about it. Actually, is this a Schrödinger cat? I've been in many discussions. It's very interesting, for instance, to read Leggett on this subject. He wrote 1980, but also afterwards papers on this, and he claims that this is a Schrödinger cat kind of system. Not exactly what he describes here is not exactly what he did, but it's sort of in that category. And Caspar van der Waal, who did the measurements with us, had his PhD defense in September, and Tony Leggett was there and others. But we never agreed. We never managed to get a consensus there. So I don't know what to say. My feeling is that... The precise question is this a Schrödinger cat state? I mean, it's a large number of Cooper pairs, a billion Cooper pairs. And is this, for instance, equivalent to having a billion atoms or photons or whatever doing something similar? And then, as I understand it, it is not. Because in our case, as I see it now, is that the Cooper pairs don't have much choice. They're in this condensate. I mean, if you take out one Cooper pair, for instance, it's not true that the rest collapse, apart from the charging effects but in our case that would not have much effect. But I mean, it's not that this whole system depends essentially on having one or more of those things. So, but there's, yeah, I know you are also, I mean, many people are very into, and I hope that also here we can have a bit more discussion on that. I would like to understand it better.
What physics will you learn, yeah, if you decide whether to call it a cat or not? Maybe
that is not so relevant, but I mean, asking a question like that makes you understand what you have much better, I think. And what you call it afterwards, I would think, is not so important.
Right, it's 1 degree of freedom for 1,000 billion particles, which happens to show quantum effect.
Yeah. Yeah, that is for sure, yeah.
Yeah. Is the question whether I have a product state of superpositions, yeah, or a superposition of products? That's a different, those are two very different kinds of states.
Yeah, no, and read Leggett on that, and he'll tell you it's not a product state, but it's, yeah, okay.
But I understand nobody has constructed the microscopic state, so
No. Sorry. If you allow me, I would like to continue, because I have not, at this time, not so much to contribute, but I think it's a very relevant and important discussion. Yeah. I mean, this is one problem. This is another one that I can't help showing to you, although it's outside of it. I mean, what we see is that if we increase the power that we apply, we see these peaks and dips. And if we put more power, this is always high power and different frequencies. Now, we see the main absorption line, the resonant line. We see harmonics, 2, 3. But we also see subharmonics. Now, this is a bit more complicated. If you believe it's a two-level system, how can you have subharmonics? And any of you who has some idea to help us here, I mean, they're there. And this... I mean, here, really, the energy is half the frequency. Yeah? How can you do that? But you see, it happens. And 1/3, and 1/4, and if we shift it, and it can't be higher levels, because the higher levels move in the opposite direction. So if we vary the frequency, I mean, this one moves in one direction, but the half moves with it. And if it's a higher level, it should move the other. If it's something else, if it's not the half level, but something else, it should move the other direction. Because the next levels have different slopes. I don't know. So, please, if you have any idea, let me know. We can do tests, any theory, any idea that you have, we can test it also. Now, what we have to do is to understand, also in this case, the interaction with the environment and what the measuring process really is, and then to optimize our measuring process. In our case, and that is very general. I talk a little bit about what we do, but this also goes for the charge state. So you have to describe in detail what you mean by making a measurement. So if you have a charge state, you're excited, and you want to determine what, I mean, you have in general a superposition of charge states on that island, and then you perform a certain measurement. In general, what you do with the charges, as well as here, is you start to influence it first in a way that you have a lot of dephasing, doesn't matter if you still want to measure it, but also the back action from the measurement will create, in general, relaxation processes because you allow dissipation to happen, etc. In our case, we have a sequence, we have the quantum loop, we have a squid that has two variables. One is a quantum variable, the other is connected to the outside, and then we have the classical environment. And this is the chain that we have to understand. If the squid is not excited, this coupling is weak, but if we ramp it up, we get strong coupling. So the idea is to ramp it up very fast so that, and as soon as the coupling is strong, this feeds back to the quantum system and destroys the quantum effect. So this has to be quantified and understood then. We are making good progress with that, and on that basis try to improve our measurement system. We can also calculate, given a certain electromagnetic circuit that we connect to the quantum bit, what the dephasing and relaxation rates are. And for the relaxation, for instance, it counts very much what the spectral density of states in the environment is at the levels plane. Okay, and we optimize it there. Now, what we have done so far is measure relaxation rates. But we have not been able yet to measure real Rabi oscillations, and that is because we clearly in our system still have too much flux noise. And we think it's not intrinsic, and we have all kinds of tricks to improve that. And let me tell you about one trick that I hope we will, really try in a few weeks. And that is related to a proposal that was made to make quantum bits using D-wave superconductors. If you take a D-wave superconductor, if you take two phases, they have different external phases. You may know the experiment by Van Herlingen, who did a squid measurement on two phases and showed that there is a pi phase difference. So if you use that to bias your, let's say, quantum loop, you have the pi, the half flux quantum, for free. All you have to do is to make two ideal D-wave tunnel junctions of sizes a few hundred nanometers. Now, nobody can do that, so I think this is, for the next 20 years, irrelevant until the technology of high-TC superconductors is on a much higher level. But we can do something similar, I think, and this has been just been tried. While I was here, this was sent to me, last week's. This is now testing it on a squid system. If we take a loop, an aluminum loop, cool it down in a field, we trap flux. No, we don't trap flux because the penetration depth for this material is many microns, much larger than the whole loop. So the field goes in and out very easily. But if we cool it down in a field, the superconductor will adapt to that field, minimize its energy by building in a fluxoid or a fluxon, which means that if you go around the loop, there is 2 pi built in, or 4 pi. If you cool it down in 3 flux quanta, it will cool down in the lowest energy. Near TC, it can still choose, and it will build in 6 pi. So we can build in 2 pi here, and if we connect it in the middle, we pick it up through a direct phase, but also by, if there are currents inductively, we can build in a pi difference. It's not exact, but we don't have to have it exact. It still helps a lot. So you can see that it works. If you do it like that, you get pi over 2, and you get the corresponding shift. So, proposal that we have now is to try this one, take a loop, chap one flux quantum in it, or let's say a fluxoid, a 2 pi phase difference running in the outer loop, strong outer loop, metallic loop, and then put this in the middle, and now it's a gradiometer. It only feels a difference between those two fluxes. And that is the way to bias it and do the measurement. That has to be asymmetric. But any noise, any flux noise from a bit further away will cancel. So this is first order gradiometer. And these objects you could also put in a good couple and then look at phase transition. This is something we also want to try. This is a quantum Ising system. We can couple it. So in principle, we can look at phase transitions, and we are already making samples. And if everything works, we can do much more. This is the most futuristic idea that we have. I mean, why not do an EPR pair, spatially separated, take two down? I mean, I hired last year a student, and I told him he has to do this experiment. I'm not sure he will manage, but it's not. It is certainly thinkable that he will, let's say in the next 3 years. So take two loops, couple them with, I mean, this may not be the best way, but in principle they should work. Put another loop around it and then make something that you can cut very fast with a voltage. And this in principle also exists. We collaborate with NTT in Japan. They have to make it smaller than it is now, but in principle that is possible. We can cut the loop. Interesting quantum question. If you couple two qubits and then cut this loop, of course there's quantum information in the loop as well. You cut it. Where does it go? I mean, we have to work that out, the theory for that. We don't know yet, but in principle that should work. Okay, the last 6-7 minutes I want to tell a bit about recent experience, very recent, not published. I just heard about them a month ago, and actually a week ago, about the other experiment. And I think they're very interesting. And also it makes a nice connection with the beginning of the talk. You remember that we had this washboard potential. This is now a single junction with a current through it. If we have a current, we get this type of potential as a function of the phase across the junction. And we have these potential wells, and if you blow up, we get these things. And one could have multiple levels there. Now, this has come back. The same people, you may remember the names Martinez and De Vries. John Martinez is now at NIST in Boulder. Michel De Vries is back in France. But Urbina is from, I mean, the same people basically picked up their own trick and used it in a different way now. John Martinez does the following. He takes a quite big junction, a large critical current. We would say a completely classical junction. But for this aspect, the quantum stuff comes in most easily. That's why it was already seen in 85 also. So he takes a junction that has three levels in the well, and they're not equally separated. It's an anharmonic oscillator there, because, I mean, the potential curves off here. So these two he plans to use as a quantum bit. So excite them using microwave pulses. As far as I know, he hasn't done it yet, but, I mean, he's about to, and maybe next week or tonight or something, he's about to do that. Anyway, the idea is to use those two as quantum states. And then the measurement, and that is the trick I like, would be is that he puts a pulse that is resonant with the 2-3 transition. So if the system is in state 2, sorry, and again I should say, 1 and 2 are well far enough below the barrier that there's very little tunneling here, I mean through the barrier. But once it's in 3, it goes very fast. And this is all exponential, it's very sensitive. If you go up a little bit here, I mean this can make 4 orders of magnitude difference in tunneling rates, easily, or more. Okay, so the measurement is just a resonant pulse between 2-3, and that decides whether the system was here or was there. So the principle is sound. But of course, I mean, there are practical things. This current biasing has to be extremely stable, because everything is exponential also to that. But people in NIST are extremely good in extremely accurate current sources. So I'll see. We'll see how far it goes. It's not easy, but he has a good chance. Now this is another one. This is the Saclay group, and it's a variation on the same principle. Again, using the junction. Now what they use, I'll show you the circuit in a minute, is a charging, more or less a charging system. But I would call, in my summary, I called it the mixed state. It's not a charge state or the phase state, but mixed state between charge and phase, not mixed state in a quantum sense. So it's a bit in between. But they use this single junction now as a detector. And what they do is, they have a state again, and this quantum tunneling is very sensitive, exponentially sensitive, to the transport current. So what they do is add a very small transport. I mean, these are real numbers, 95, 96 of the critical current, and this is just plotting what it does. And then, of course, you have to put in the real numbers for the system. So what they do now, or they did already, is take the following circuit. This is the what we call the Cooper pair box. So we have charge states here, and they can be controlled with a gate here. So they have 0 or 1 Cooper pair there. These are the 2 charge states. Now, usually in the Cooper pair box, you have a capacitor, but you have a junction here. In this case, the junction is a double junction, like a squid. And now, because it's double and it's connected here, there is a current in this loop. And the current in that loop depends on the charge state. It's a small current, very small current, because these junctions are very weak, much weaker than the junction that we use in our qubit. This is in a charge regime. EC over EJ is something like 5 here. So these are small junctions, it's a very small current. But it goes one way if it's in a 0 state, and the other way if it's in a 1 state. That's what you calculate. Now, in this loop, there is a big junction of the type that I showed you before. And this junction, the tunneling, it's biased, and this bias is ramped up very fast. So this measurement is done very fast. This current doesn't feed back too much to this. Anyway. So this is now the detector. So it measures whether the current adds or subtracts to the applied bias current. And that sounds normal, but what they do in practice is now calculate everything with the quantum equations and then optimize. They know there's charge noise, they know there's phase noise, and they have 3 controls. They have a current, a voltage, and another flux here. Now this is the measurement thing, but those 2 they use to find an operating point where the first derivative versus charge is 0, and the first derivative for flux is 0. And I'm amazed that it's possible. I would think if you find that point, it feels nothing and you see nothing, but that happens not to be true. So there is a point, and they've reached it, where the derivatives, and they can tune it with those 2 objects here, to bias the system in that point where charge noise in particular and phase noise and flux noise don't, in first order, don't contribute. And of course, a little bit. And then they do the measurement. In principle, this measurement, if they do the calculation, is a single shot measurement with a 95% reliability. 95%, which is very high. They haven't done it, but this is the paperwork. Yeah. And they are good. I mean, they know what they calculate. So it's not, I mean, don't think of it as a fake statement. It's serious. Now, and this is what they sent me 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago or so. So this has been measured very recently. So they have seen Rabi oscillations now, and they also did their first pulse experiment. The efficiency is something like 30% instead of 95, and they don't know why, etc. So it's not as good as they calculated, but it's fantastic, and the whole field is in motion again. We are all very happy about that. So this is what I planned to tell you. I hope I gave you some idea of a field that is not going in big jumps every week, because each experiment takes a long time, it's difficult, but it's moving very steadily, and we haven't hit a brick wall yet. I mean, there are many things that we can do. So we have high expectations, and I mean, as you see, things are moving, and I think we will have more results in the coming years. Thank you.
Questions? slice, their circumcision is measuring current?
Yeah, they put a current pulse here that is designed to distinguish, I mean, the height of the current is just so, let's say, let me go back. Suppose, I mean, there's a level here, and then if the current is slightly different, in one case it would tunnel and the other would not. So in one case the current adds to the bias, so the bias is chosen just to be in between. I mean, between not tunneling and tunneling. Yeah. This the current, the charge state here determines a current in this loop. That was new for me, but I looked at it and it's true. I mean, I could also easily calculate it, but I hadn't realized that was true, that there was a current there. But it is.
Coming back to the usage of the word macroscopic.
Yeah.
No, there is nothing holy about 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 30. Now, suppose one would have a strict definition. Macroscopic means that you can make the system larger and larger, each time increase it by an order of magnitude, and the effect will persist. That's something that many theoreticians like. They call it the thermodynamic limit. You can make it larger and things just per unit volume stay the same. Now, I think what will happen here, if you make the system larger, your capacitance is going to become larger, the tunnel frequency is going to become smaller, and then it will hit the coherence time. So, you know, it can be macroscopically large, but doesn't satisfy this.
But the coherence time is not an intrinsic thing. I mean, that is something that
actually decreases when you make the system larger, from what we understand, right? So it's beautiful, it's fantastic that you can get coherence in a system which is, by every day almost macroscopic, but it's not that it will continue to do that, making it 1 kilometer. Eventually it will die.
Of course, I would argue that given enough money and time, you could make it a kilometer. I mean, all you have to do is make a big cryostat and make the temperature a bit lower. I mean, if we make it bigger, actually, I mean, if we make a circuit of, I mean, our
isolated much better.
No. I mean, the problem we have is the measurement. If we don't have the measurement, I believe our system, certainly our loops, are very stable. I think we can easily make 10,000. I mean, we have made 10,000 of them. We can couple them. I don't think the problem is there. The problem is in the connection to the environment, and that is only on the outside in the measurement. So if you talk about macroscopic quantum state, the intrinsic property of that quantum object, I think that is macroscopic in that sense, in the way you say. And yeah, there will be something perhaps, but it's really the connection, the fact that we need a measurement that creates our problem. And all the other decoherence effects are not increasing when we increase the size of the system.
Could be clever and make the measurement more and more delicate.
Yeah, and lower the temperature if you want. But okay, we haven't done one quantum bit, except in a few cases now, so I shouldn't say too much, but I would claim that it is macroscopic for many years to come.
Could you measure the dependence of the decoherence time on the separation of the two states that are brought to superposition?
Not yet, sorry. In our system, we are planning to test all these things, but so far what we measure are times that are much too short compared with what they should be, and we know that it's due to, still our measuring circuit. So we are improving our measuring circuit. And I showed you, for instance, this gradiometer, and I think that will help a lot. And then, we will also on purpose change the electromagnetic environment and test the spin boson type theory for decoherence. And I say at this time we try to optimize to get the longest times, but as soon as we have that, we also test the theory there, but we have to connect first.
No further questions. Thank the speaker again.